The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn on this April 12th, 2014. It will definitely be about Carolyn and my views on a number of current issues. I have no guests today, but I will welcome your phone calls in the second hour at 830-443-4911. I want to thank a couple of people for their donations. Once again, Jaime Schwartz for his regular monthly donation that's so much appreciated. And also Mari from Nevada for a generous donation to me. I have received a donation from Mari in the past, maybe more than one, but I do remember her name. M-A-R-I, did I say that? I assume it's a female. And so I also want to say that on my list of topics for today, I'm glad I said as time permits, because I know now I won't get to the last one, which I've been trying to write about and been trying to, well, first I was going to write about it, and that is the story about the Natzweiler Struthof camp and whether 86 Jews were gassed there or not. And I looked into it right after the program that I had discussed it on a little bit. And I was, you know, oh, that was the one with Charles Kraft, on the, supposed falsely attributed, occult roots to National Socialism and what they call Nazism, excuse me. And I was unhappy that I ran out of time, which of course I should realize, and it just didn't go very well. So I thought, well, I'll just write about it. And I looked up, I found a lot of very interesting information that I think should be brought out. And then I got so busy with things, this and that, and I got too involved in comments, which can happen very easily. Then I didn't get any further on it, and I thought, well, I'll pull that material out that I have, and I'll talk about it a little bit, but I'm not going to be able to do that. So I think I will deal with that on Monday, since what I have, various ideas I had for Monday haven't worked out, so I might do that on Monday. But I should get to the rest of the topics, and I'm going to start out by talking about white nationalism and my thoughts that have been developing for some time now, quite some time. But, you know, very just thoughts coming to me, and nothing I would be willing to say out loud or in public. But I've always been a supporter of white nationalists, and I've had lots of white nationalists on my radio programs. Even before we formed the White Network, when I was on Voice of Reason on the Heretics Hour, and, you know, being very positive toward them and so on. And so, but I've been, I've been thinking of, you know, what's being accomplished, really. And I know that I'm not a person who's going to go out and do anything. I mean, I have a good excuse. I'm too old. So nobody would expect me to do it. And sometimes I expect myself, and then I realize that, you know, I make unreasonable expectations of myself, and nobody else does. So there's no need to do that. But so it's kind of hard to criticize something that you're not, to criticize the lack of something that you're not willing to go and fill in and do yourself. But now I've come to a kind of a More of the intellectual or the intellectual support or framework, right, for white nationalism, and what it is. And yeah, I'm always saying that I don't know how to define it. I have a lot of love for the white race, and I have a lot of love for a lot. I have love and respect for a lot of white nationalists that I know, and I know there's amongst white nationalists, they just, you know, there's different groups and some dislike others. So that's nothing new. But I decided to finally look into it a little bit, and not knowing where, and not as I'm Googling white nationalism and what is white nationalism and when did white nationalism begin and questions like that, I didn't come up with anything very good, anything better than Wikipedia. You know, Wikipedia always has at least some kind of respectable, organized information on any subject. So, I was driving around yesterday, and I was thinking some things I was hearing on the car radio were making me have these thoughts about white nationalism, and I I've had these before, but it came kind of, it sort of focused in for me that it could be seen and it could be a cop out, and I was using that word for myself in my own mind, that maybe it has become a cop out because you don't have to do anything, you don't have to be anything, you don't even have to stand for anything, you just have to be white and say you're a white nationalist. So, and I was thinking of it as being kind of an amorphous mass of something that nobody is sure what it should be anymore. And that might be too critical, but, you know, I believe in looking at things critically and seeing where it takes me. So I'm not, you know, I don't have any final views, but I have some, I'm going in a certain direction here. So I will tell you that looking for a definition, the Wikipedia says that the term white nationalist originated as a self-description by some groups, primarily in the United States, and for this there's citation needed, nobody's got any source for this, but to describe their belief in a racially defined collective identity of white people. So as I've said previously on programs, there is before a certain date, and I found this now to be true in looking into the so-called history, there was nothing about white. It was nationalism was all nation based, and but when white nations started becoming started suffering from immigration and globalization and so on, then came up the idea that we needed to do something in to help white people in the name of white people or as white people. We needed to do something for our own selves and our own children and progeny and so on. So I'm just going to go through a little bit of background information here. I'm sorry, all of a sudden I've got something in my throat. Well, there have been different racial theories, such as Nordicism and Germanism, which define different groups as white, both of which exclude some Southern and Eastern Europeans because of a perceived racial taint, well, because they're not considering them fully white. And then then came along Pan-Aryanism, which defines whites as individuals native to Europe, the Americas, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and Western Asia, who are wholly of Caucasian lineage and are overwhelmingly from the following Caucasian ethnic groups or any combination thereof, which would be Indo-European, which is Aryan, including the Iranian people, Indo-Aryan peoples, And then there's old, or there's old, and also old European is included in the Aryan, which are like, for example, the Basque, and Hamitic, in modern times, confined to Berbers. That's the inclusion of Aryanism and white, what could be considered white people. But then, you know, I was looking for, well, who first, that's not too important, but who first used the term white nationalist or white nationalism? And, you know, it's hard to find anything on that. And I have to take this from a book by a Jew, Leonard Zeskind, in his 2009 book, Blood and Politics. And he says that there was three people, he calls them plotters, on the fringe of the American mainstream: Willis Carto, William Pierce, and David Duke. So these are the three that are named here, and I don't have too much disagreement with that, and I don't find anything else about it. But Willis Carto, now this is all post-World War II, and Willis Carto started fairly early, but David Duke, I think, preceded William Pierce. But anyway, maybe not. William Pierce is pretty early. Anyway, these three men are seen as the grandfathers of racist politics. And when the Cold War ended, see, now we're past the, it really took off because in the 40s and probably the 50s, Americans had no truck with anything like this. And this is when a lot of the groundwork for expanding immigration and changing the nature of our countries was going on. But now we're dealing here with the U.S., you see, Willis Carto, William Pierce, and David Duke. So really, white nationalism is completely associated with the United States of America. And then it has spread, the idea has spread to many Europeans who have their own nationalism, plus they embrace white nationalism. Well, let's go into this a little more here. When the Cold War ended, the traditional conservatives helped birth a new white nationalism, most evident among anti-immigrant organizations. And with the dawn of the new millennium, 2000, we're up to all, you know, talking about here, they're predicting that white people will lose their majority status and become one minority among many. Well, of course, that's happened. We know that. I mean, that's a... It was said all along that, oh, this was some dire prediction these people were believing in, but it really is not the case. Somebody's calling, but I can't answer the phone right now. I'm not going to answer and take any calls until, as I said, the second hour. Please hold off and call in the second hour. We can talk about anything you want. We know that these fears were always well-founded. And in the U.S., now we're going to go on to how this took place in the U.S., where it started. Well, the Naturalization Act of 1790 limited naturalization to immigrants who were free white persons and of good moral character. Everybody was agreed on that. This was a long time ago, 1790. But then came along the next thing that seemed to be important was the Chinese Exclusion Act, which I don't have a date for, but it allowed, because they wanted to keep out the Chinese and justify that, it allowed more recent European newcomers, such as the Irish, to unite with the founding white stock Americans to halt the non-European immigration. So this was where white groups that had previously been not approved of too much were now added in to included with who was white. And then there was a group that formed in 1905 called itself the Asiatic Exclusion League, and that was in San Francisco, and it was formed and supported by labor unions and labor leaders who were European immigrants, and they attempted to influence legislation restricting Asian immigration. Well, it seems as though none of these had long lasting success, but we jump to the Ku Klux Klan, which was founded as an insurgent group with the goal of maintaining the Southern racial system throughout the Reconstruction era, and we're familiar with that. But there was a second incarnation of the Ku Klux Klan between 1915 and 1940s, which was successful during that period. In fact, it may have been one of the most successful white movements that we've had in the United States. It was oriented toward what it called white nationalism, or somebody's calling it that now, and American nativism, with slogans such as 100% Americanism and America for Americans. This second wave in the 20th century was had at its peak in the mid 1920s. Included 4 to 5 million men as members, and that is 15% of the nation's eligible population. So it reached the 15% level, which we would consider very, very, very good. But today, some parties in Europe are anti-immigrant parties in Europe are reaching the 20% level. So that might be the kind of high point. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't mean to be negative, but that might be the level that what's called when you're successful that you can get to. It's hard to get past that. Now, it says, and again, this is not written by friends, but it's probably true that the KKK membership collapsed because of internal divisions, criminal behavior by leaders, which I can sure believe, and external opposition. Those are just the things you would imagine, you would know are true. And it had dropped to about 30,000 by 1930 from the 4 to 5 million that it had. I'm really sorry. I should turn off my mic to do this. In the 1940s, it faded away. Well, naturally, that was wartime. And once you go to war, everybody becomes patriotic and every man counts. And, you no longer feel you have the luxury to, fight amongst yourselves. You need to fight against an enemy. And so this has brought an end to many of our movements, to improve the population of our countries, but in this case, the United States. So then again, starting in the 1960s, though, white nationalism grew as it was a conservative movement developed, they say. And Samuel P. Huntington is someone who argues that it developed as a reaction to a perceived decline in the essence of American identity as European, Anglo-Protestant, and English-speaking. So at this point, there was still anti-Catholicism and a dislike of certain European groups that were not Anglo-Protestant and English-speaking enough. And then we go to George Lincoln Rockwell, and he was in the 60s, but he came up with the slogan White Power. So white power is fairly new, as along with white nationalism. And after that, William Luther Pierce founded the National Alliance in 1974. Now think how long ago that was. I never quite keep it in mind how early it was that he first that this all was taking place with Pierce, because I think of him as more, you know, more like around the 1990s or so. But he founded this National Alliance in 1974. It lasted until the early 2000s, or it still exists, but he died somewhere early, I believe it was early 2000. And then it seems to me that things pretty much stopped. No one has taken hold. No one has been able to get things going. The National Alliance declined to a do-nothing organization pretty much at this point. And you can ask why all this happens. Well, the answer could be the advance of the forces against whites that has been ongoing, and the increase of people's subjection to media, although that we were always subjected to media. But this, I think, is a valid question. Why did this, why have we made so little progress since then? And these parties, these organizations and groups, while they had a following, and while they made a difference, they never got to the level that would be needed. So I thought I'd look for to find out who was white in the United States. I found that by the 18th century, white had become well established as a racial term. According to someone named John Turanian, among those considered white in American history have been Greeks, white Hispanics, Arabs, Iranians, Afghans, Jews, Slavs, and Spaniards. So a lot of these people, you see, these have been considered white, but we don't consider a lot of these groups white. We don't consider white Hispanics, Arabs, and Iranians and Afghans as white. But some people might. Some people might. So still today, the relationship with ethnic groups and whiteness remains complex. In 1923, there's some court there. This is just a kind of a interesting item. In 1923, the Supreme Court decided in the United States versus Bhagat Singh, Thind, that's a totally Indian name, that people of Indian descent were not white men and thus not eligible to citizenship. Now, this is in 1923. We still had a law against non-white people, non-Europeans becoming citizens. Even though this man took it to the Supreme Court, it went all the way to the Supreme Court because he was a high caste Hindu from northern Punjab. So in the 1920s, things were still holding on after the war. After World War II, things began to change, and then they changed more after the Cold War, where we didn't have the Russians and as our enemies and you know, seeing it that way, and then we became more, the white nationalist movement probably became more clearly what it is today. And then I'm thinking, about who is white. Is somebody white because they look white? Because where I'm going with this is we're not all the same. You know, I've said this many times before. I've done programs, you know, kind of around this subject. Are all white people equal? And so, whites have, they're different groups of people, and even our skin is different. We have fair-skinned whites. We have, rosy goes along with fair skin, and we have olive-skinned whites. And I couldn't really find any other descriptions of skin besides those two of truly white people. And so the question is that I'm bringing up today is does white nationalism feed into the idea that all whites are equal? That's what I think it does. And that's what I think can be a problem for us making progress by trying to unite too many people together and have this, what I call this political correct attitude that to say that we're not all equal is not allowed, because it's the people who are seen as not as equal as others don't like it, and we need all these people together. And to me, it's the essence of political correctness, as to that you can't offend anyone because we're all one big thing. It's very much follows the idea that there's no race and that all human beings are the same and are one, and that has to be adhered to in the public dialogue. And in the white nationalist dialogue, saying that all whites are equal and interchangeable has to be adhered to also, it seems, or you get into trouble with a whole lot of white nationalists or white people, whether they're white nationalists or not. But so I went so far as to say, and because I was thinking this very much, this is the first time I got this idea was yesterday while I was driving around with Friday, yes. And that maybe it could be said that white nationalism is a tool, or not is a tool, but is used by as a tool of the globalist internationalist Jews to keep us functioning in a way that's ineffective, because we're trying to do something, we're trying to hold together an ideal that's impossible, and which they also they can infiltrate and control much more easily because of the size of it. I've been quite for some time also toying with the idea, and I tend to say that this is the way I see it, that the only true nationalism can be a national blood and soil type nationalism to our nation, as we find in Europe, and that the idea that we have this problem in America because we can't fit into that mold. You know, I mean, it's very easy to understand British nationalism and to be a British nationalist. Very easy to understand German nationalism in the same way, and French nationalism, Italian nationalism, Polish nationalism, Greek nationalism. All those are clearly, they make sense. American nationalism, well, we know that's a tough one. We don't know how to handle that. We haven't handled it very well. How do we do it? I think there has not been. The answer to American nationalism has been white nationalism. And that has been an American thing. But as I said, now a lot of European nationalists have taken that on too and say, well, they're, say, someone in France, I'm a French nationalist, I also support white nationalism, and we should all support one another, we should all network with one another, we should all realize we're all one and be in this together. They say that, but the only activity they're taking is for their country's nationalism. Now, I would say Russia's in the same boat as the United States and Canada. Canada doesn't have too much nationalism going on that I know of. I'm forgetting something, but Russian nationalism is another tough one, because that's another large multicultural empire type affair, just like America has become, United States has become. And so how do you practice nationalism? There are Russian nationalists, just like there are white nationalists in Russia, and they call themselves Russian nationalists, but they're not accepted by their government any more than we are accepted by our government. So, and then another thing I've noticed is that everyone tends to think that the movements going on in other countries than their own are doing very well. But even when they're not, because they know there's some people there, they think they're doing a lot, and only in your own country do you know what's really going on. And so people want to be positive about it and think well. So a lot of Europeans will think that there's a lot more going on here in the United States than there is. And of course, they're all aware of William Pierce and that not thinking about how long that's been, you know, not having any influence, except in people remembering it and thinking well of it and passing that material around and so on. But, and we think that there's a lot going on in Europe. We in the United States think that there's, we think, oh boy, you know, and we're looking to these parties and movements in Europe as doing the trick, doing the job, you know, because it's not being done here. So, in France, well, they're going to get some seats there and they're going to get some seats in, maybe Austria will get something. Well, look at Hungary. Look at what Hungary's doing. Wow. You know, we're on a roll there. So we're looking for that to them to do it. A lot of those people are looking to us to do it. And you'll hear them say, well, I think the United States is where it's going to happen. Is where, you know, if you live in the United States and you're aware of the white nationalist scene, I don't see how anybody can be so positive about it. But I welcome people with different views. I really do. I'm not trying to, nor do I have any illusion that I'm the person to say what's what about any of this, nor do I want to. In fact, I don't even want to talk about white nationalism, but I keep being, feeling, or being put in a position because I am a white supporter, a supportive of white movements and white nations. I end up in it, even though I'd like to let other people do it. But I don't think other people are doing what needs to be done. And I think there is a lot of, did I use this word already? I'll call it cheerleading or just, you know, rah, rah, rah stuff that people write and people talk about what we know the problem is over and over again. We all do that. I do that. What else is there to do? I mean, it's terrible what's happening. And I've got a little bit of that coming up about terrible things that are happening and going on. And, we can't seem to stop it. Why I think that it's acceptable for me to be saying these things is because if we're not finding success in what we're doing, well, we need to look at it and talk about it openly and admit it and do something different. Now, I'm going to bring up something that I do not endorse, that I just learned about, I don't know that it's any good, but it's interesting, okay? It's interesting as somebody's alternative viewpoint, which is similar to my own, and I just discovered this yesterday, I think. European Knights Project, it's called, and they have there's a website, European Knights Project. .org. And I read what was on the front page there, and then they have an about page, so I went to the about page, and I think everything I've got here is from the about page to find out who they are. And I have this sneaking suspicion that the person who's heading this is the guy who comments at the Daily Stormer by the name of Wolf. And He has written different kind of things which have left me a little uncertain just what he stands for and who he stands with and what he's all about. But if this is him, then I understand it a little bit better. But he, the person who does this website has written about himself only that he founded this European Knights Project in 2002, and that the founding person's name is a writer and political activist named Gio Wolf, and he operates this as a think tank, and he calls himself an academic because he says he has a BA from Princeton and an MA from State University of New York. Well, I don't think that makes him, he's got degrees, but I don't know that that doesn't make him an academic, but he wants you to know that he's not just some dummy. He's an educated person and all of that. And he's, so then he says, it's a think tank to counter and a counter to prevailing Marxist bias. Of course, he's very much against cultural Marxism, but he says that our approach is different from other political organizations, both in terms of policy and ideology. The, European Knights Project operates via a system of networks, some overtly political, some community-based, some informal, others covert. Now, I don't know whether, you know, he's making it to sound a whole lot more than what's actually going on, I would think, but anyway. Employing a highly skilled team of online activists dedicated to liberating people of European origin from their internationalist captors. Well, that sounds good if it's if they're actually have a real network going on. We wouldn't know because they're not going to tell you if they're part of this or not. So then a little further down on this about page, I'm going to read this here. He says, just for the helpful information that it contains, this might be slightly off-putting to some of you, but I genuinely believe if you understand our platform and why we believe our way is the best way forward, you'll join us in our global struggle against the evils of internationalism. I will say right now that further on, he indicates that he is living in Spain and that he's a Spaniard, a European Spaniard. But at the same time, he went to Princeton and State University in New York. I don't know, where he would be now, where he would be located, but it sounds like it would be probably in Europe. It goes on, in spite of what our Zionist detractors claim, the European Knights Project have absolutely nothing in common with neo-Nazi skinheads, the KKK, Aryan Nation, American far right. Both fascism and National Socialism are centrist ideologies. In another place, he calls himself a National Socialist, but here he's rejecting National Socialism as centrist and not enough devoted to a single European nation or any other pseudo-patriotic organization calling for a worldwide alliance along racial lines. pseudo-patriotic, he's calling all of these things. A little bit stuck up, I think, but anyway. Nor do we have anything in common with Zionist-controlled Christianist shills, xenophobes, Islamophobes like Anders Behring Breivik, and let me reiterate, any interest partaking in a communistic global white struggle. Now, if he's anti-Christian, he calls it Christianist shills, that might not make him anti-Christian. Christian, because I, you know, my impression of this Wolf at Daily Stormer is that he was definitely defending the Christian standpoint at times, but other times you would never know it. I might be all wet in connecting the two. Let me reiterate that I don't know about this connection at all. I was just, you know, how you do. You put things together in your mind to see if it, you know, you think it might be. Now here he's going to tell you about his thoughts about white nationalism. White nationalism is nothing more than insidious internationalism dressed up in a racialist overcoat. While people of European descent have an obligation to their forefathers to remain racially aware, our racial bonds should never trump our ethnic, cultural, and national allegiances. Well, this is kind of the opposite of what so many say. They say race comes first. Well, they'll say race comes first, religion comes next. This is the difference between someone with a European point of view and those with an American point of view. He says, once we allow them to, we're no better than the internationalist, tribalist Jews exploiting our nations for their brethren in Israel. Anyone calling for a worldwide revolution based on any sort of international alliance, quite similar to the communistic call for a worldwide worker revolt, is a globalist, traitor to their country of origin, and enemy to true nationalism. Now, some people might have already decided that this is a fake enemy, website put out to mislead and distract white nationalists or people like myself, and very well could be. However, I should add that in Europe, among the nationalist movements, most of these people want to join together, and they see all Europe as being all white Europe, as including Eastern Europe, and they don't exactly include Russia but they would if there was a group they could connect with there, as joining together in the end, to make a white Europe and so on, or with countries that keep their identities and so on. This seems to be the ideal that most people see. That fits in with white nationalism worldwide. But this person is not going along with this. He says that's just another internationalist, communistic type way of thinking. I'll just try to... They fight for the sovereignty of individual Western European nation states. He says white nationalism will open our borders to the culturally incompatible people of Eastern Europe and spell doom for Western civilization, as it did when we permitted another group of wayward Eastern Europeans into our lands, the Ashkenazim. So this is one thing that this organization is standing for, that Western civilization does not include Eastern Europe, and they don't want what is going on now in the EU, all these Eastern Europeans moving in and having the right to come into Western Europe and at will, and taking jobs and changing the whole culture because there's so many of them there. He says, by our supporting nationalist organizations in Romania, Turkey, Poland, Ukraine and beyond, we are stemming the tsunami of immigration from both white and non-white, non-Western nations that's ravaging our land. So now there you have, we want to support these people in their own nationalist aspirations, but at the same time, we don't see them the same as us, and we don't want them coming into Western Europe. They're very focused here on Western Europe. supporting white nationalism, on the other hand, will open our borders to the culturally incompatible people of Eastern Europe and South America. Then he says, we are eager to develop a mutually beneficial relationship with our Eastern European neighbors, as well as our cousins in the New World, the U.S., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, whom we actively support in their quest for national sovereignty and liberation from Zionist oppression, NAFTA, anti-American foreign policy, and globalization. Those are the enemies. And finally, he says, will also rid us of insidious America, cultural American should be, cultural Marxism, peddled to us via Hollywood and the globalist American media. So, the mainstream everywhere is seen as the enemy, but they are more... I'm going to read his bottom line here. They want Western Europe to be separate, and that they see that as a culture that doesn't include anybody else. Says bottom line on this page is white nationalism is the antithesis of true nationalism, and the EKP, European Knights Project. It's white nationalism is the antithesis of the European Knights Project. Although I am fiercely proud of being of European stock, I have no desire to embrace the communistic idea that some villager from Prussia is my brother simply because we share a common ancestry 25,000 years back, and I'd advise you all to think likewise. So, you know, I'm not going to say any more from this person or this website. You can go there yourself if you want to, EuropeanKnightsProject.org. It's just to show that there is another view, alternative to white nationalism, that is still white, that is still anti-everything non-white, but that it has a different position on how to go about this. And I don't see why a dialogue about these things would be bad. There might be tons of angry people that comes from it, but what are you going to do? I mean, you can't bring things out that people are sensitive to. If you're not going to talk about things people are sensitive to, then you're going to be in denial about it all. And I think that's one reason why we're not making the progress we should be making. We still look to those three people, William Pierce and David Duke, and to maybe a lesser extent, but he's still very active. Can't think of his name now. You know, the other one, Barnes Review owner. There it is. Willis Carto. He's still quite active. He's been a powerhouse, Willis Carto. But we still look to these people and what they've done and their work and so on as being what we're all about. And we haven't gotten we don't seem to be getting any new blood that's really of the same caliber. Now, there may be very good explanations for this. This is what I would like to hear. And I would like to see this being discussed. And I'm not going to try to lead it. I don't need to lead it. I really would like to talk about other things, but here I am. Now, going on from that, I want to go now into my second topic, the business about Russia and the fact that what kind of leadership Russia can provide for the white world, which I have made it pretty well known that I don't think that's where any leadership is. But there was, should all know by now that Russian lawmakers of President Putin's own party, his own party, introduced a bill. Once again, it had already been introduced before and didn't make it, but they introduced it again and maybe made some changes in it, making Holocaust denial illegal in Russia with some pretty stiff fines and prison sentences. And also, of course, anything praising Nazism or Adolf Hitler and all of that kind of thing attached to it. And it has passed in the lower house of parliament, and it's going to be going on. It's going on to the higher house. You know, in my opinion, it's going to be approved, and it's going to be voted on, and it's going to pass, and Putin is going to sign it into law. That's my view. I don't see how. I think if it's his party that's bringing it up, I don't see how he's not behind it. And people want to say, well, you don't know what he'll do. He won't. That just seems to me pretty obviously, pretty transparently dishonest. I think you know that. I'm not going to go into any more details, but I will talk about these two things that what we've forgotten probably because it wasn't so important to us. In 2013, in May, there was a story from Russia stating that the number of extremist crimes committed in Russia increased by nearly 12% in 2012. And so Vladimir notice this is extremist crimes. So Vladimir Putin called on prosecutors to take on the threat of extremism. And at a meeting he had with the prosecutors, and after detailing the statistics to support his concern about extremism, Putin voiced concern that they were acting especially bold and aggressive. Now, these extremist groups, a lot of them are white groups, but they might not all be, you know, they might have all kinds of extremist groups. But the white nationalists, white nationalists, white Russian nationalists are included in this. And so Putin is telling the prosecutors, it's your direct responsibility to address the most definite and uncompromising, in the most definite and uncompromising way, any attempts to incite ethnic and religious hatred. Well, that's the white groups doing that, and to promote xenophobia and chauvinism. So those things are not wanted any more than they're wanted in the European Union, in Putin's Russia. He says we need to act consistently and in accordance with the law and avoid double standards and bias, naturally. And he added at the end here that xenophobia and national and religious intolerance threaten Russia's unity, noting that combating extremism is a priority task. This was last year in May. In January of last year, there was a story that came out that Benito Mussolini's book, The Third Way, had been declared extremist by a court. And earlier in September of the previous year, I guess, the investigators initiated a probe after reports of the Third Way was being sold in several Moscow bookstores, along with an early Joseph Goebbels novel, Michael. Both books were published and distributed to the stores by a certain publishing house, and a criminal case was opened on the grounds of inciting hatred. So more than 2,000 copies of The Third Way, Mussolini's book, had been sold, and they issued a warning to the stores that not to sell anymore. And the federal, that's about it. Another, in December 2012, a Moscow court added Nazi ideologist Alfred Rosenberg's book, Myth of the 20th Century, and memoirs, as well as Viktor Pranov's book, Survival Law of the Foulest, to the list of extremist literature banned from publication and sale. Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf has also been banned as extremist in Russia. So there you go, and I really find people's argument that, well, considering the war against the fascist Germans and the way the Russians look at it and how that's so such an important part of their history, they can't do otherwise. You know, how could they? It doesn't mean they really mean it. You know, that is so. Again, transparently trying to talk to people like they're juveniles and brain dead idiots. Of course they mean it. And the government of Germany has no trouble denouncing the Hitler regime in the Hitler years and denouncing everything that was done in the war on the side of the Russians. But the Russians can't move toward that and say, well, maybe we'll all do that. I wouldn't be happy with that. But I mean, it could be done. You know, it'd be something, but they won't do that. Nobody does that. So there's something going on there and they're all working together. The globalists of the European Union and the globalists of the Russian Federation are all working together. So you're not going to be saved or helped by this guy who people are trying to present him as something that doesn't fit what he's ever been, and showing pictures of him looking so regal and, you know, having so much good sense and so on, and looking like such a fine guy and so white and so on. It just doesn't, you know, it's all propaganda, not in our best interest. So now, oh boy, I'm almost used up this whole hour. I cannot believe it. Oh boy. Latest news from Ukraine, I'll go through real quick. I just looked at before the show, which I say Putin intends to eventually take over the eastern Ukraine with troops. And in this town in eastern Ukraine, a mayor said the man who seized the police station were demanding a referendum on autonomy and possible annexation by Russia. And a regional news website said another police station had been seized in the town of another town's name near Slovansk. But the report could not be immediately confirmed. Anyway, in the face of protesters, following the same way that the West does, sets up their phony protests and makes out that the whole nation or wants to have a change of leadership and regime. That's exactly what Russia is doing now. First in Crimea and now in eastern Ukraine, that they all want to go back to Russia. And my prediction is that that, as I said, Putin will eventually take over eastern Ukraine with his troops. Well, we're going to the break, and we'll have a listen to those American ballads, and then we'll be back more on Saturday afternoon.
Down in the valley so low, hang your head over, hear the wind blow, hear the wind blow. Love whom you please, throw your arms round me, give my heart ease, give my heart ease, dear, give my heart ease, throw your arms round me, give my heart ease. Roses love sunshine, violets love dew, angels in heaven know I love you, know I love you. This valley, they say you are leaving. We will miss your bright eyes and sweet smile. For they say you are taking the sunshine that has brightened our pathway wild. Come and sit by my side if you love me. Not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember the Red River Valley and the one who has loved you so true. For a long time, my darling, I've waited for the sweet word. Say now at last all my fun.
say that you're going away. How about a mandolin solo? This is the verse that that makes me think I kind of know why the guy's going away. Because she is whining. Do you think of the valley you're leaving? Oh, how lonely, how drear it will be. Do you think of the kind heart you're breaking? And the pain that you're causing to me. Come and sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember the Red River Valley and the one who has loved you so true.
Take it, friend.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn on April 12th, 2014. And I did say I would take calls in this hour. But before anybody calls, give me just a few minutes here to do one thing I want to do, to kind of finish up with this subject, and then call in. The number is when I get on to the Yobbik Party and Eurasianism. So this number is 1-830-443-4911. I want to make some comments on what Andrew Anglin has put on his Daily Stormer site just today, and I just saw it right before the show. And I just find these kind of this stuff from Andrew to be very, very disappointing. And he himself, though, says that he writes on this. It's called Final Apology for Vladimir Putin. Well, it's not much of an apology, and I don't know why he sets it that way. Obviously, he's been getting he's sensitive to the criticism that he gets, and he doesn't really have any answer to it. He doesn't have an intellectual or valid answer to it, but he comes up with this. And he writes himself that, though it is highly disappointing that my position on this man and his country continues to be misconstrued, but this may be partially my fault. Well, he has said things like this over and over again, that when he takes a position that's wrong, he then can't say my position was wrong, but he says it's been misconstrued. People didn't understand. And here he goes on. He blames it on those of us who call him on what he's doing that is, in my mind, tends toward the irresponsible and the lack of enough knowledge of what he's talking about. And he says, I have, in the course of covering the Ukraine situation, used poetic license, which I thought could be taken as such, but which it seems some people do not clearly understand. You see, it's always the other guy's fault. And why would you be using poetic license in a serious subject like this? He says, it is possible that when having quite a bit of fun writing the article, so he's having fun, I took the romanticism and poetic license beyond what was reasonable. Okay, I'll just look at that first, that first part of that sentence. Well, as I already said, poetic license has no place in serious geopolitical happenings. It shows unseriousness and irresponsibility, as I already said. That's what I think it is. And beyond what is reasonable, see how I think he chooses that word. He's choosing his words very carefully. Reasonable. It's beyond what was reasonable. He should have said beyond what was responsible. That's what he should have said, but he doesn't. And then he goes on, but it is only a vocal minority which appears to have taken things that way. Oh, only a vocal minority which appears. He's always adding words like that to take away from him actually stating something as a hard, definite fact. He adds words like that. It appears, so he can back out in some way. What was intended was to provide positive propaganda in response to the negative propaganda of the establishment media. Well, I will agree that he's a propagandist and that he's talking about providing, and I think he knows that too, and he believes that's what is needed, and that's what he's providing is propaganda, but he calls that positive propaganda, which I think it's been from the beginning misleading and wrong propaganda. And, you know, I've been friends with Andrew for a long time. If you talk in terms of internet relationships, it's a long time. It's not that long, but we have chatted together quite a lot in the past, and he wouldn't turn on me, but he lets all these commenters on his site do it. But I've never wanted to turn on him, but I found these kinds of things that he writes from the very beginning. Of the time he was on Total Fascism, and I myself called him on some things, and he didn't like it, but eventually he had to agree that he was wrong, and he would say, "Well, I was wrong, but I didn't mean it in the way people took it, but I shouldn't have worded it the way I did, so you know I'm taking that out or changing it or whatever." And this has gone on as a regular occurrence. And I never want to make anything public, and I'm only doing it now, not to attack Andrew or to think that I'm going to hurt Andrew. I don't believe I have the power or whatever to hurt Andrew. But I think Andrew really needs to be called out on some of this stuff he's doing. I really do, and I've made myself clear privately, but it doesn't, it doesn't change anything. So I'll just say here at the very end of this, the last thing I've got here that he said is that the main relevance of Putin to me is his capacity and apparent willingness to serve as an ally for forces within Europe, along with his ability and willingness to stand against mutual enemies. Well, who is the enemy? It's like, the enemy is the West, and therefore Putin, who has always been in what's shown outwardly to be the counter to the West, or the against the West, or the West against him. You know, the same old Cold War stuff that doesn't really die. And so how is it that, Putin can be our ally, just because the West is run by globalist, Jewish globalists, and for him to think that, and so many others to think that Putin, although you can see all his ties to Jews and globalists and so on, somehow doesn't really mean it, that he's not serious about it. He really harbors, a white nationalist spirit. And he's going to do all this for us and practically save us. He says he's not. He hasn't said Putin is going to save us, but he has implied that very, very, very clearly. So this is more about this whole business that's been going on, which I think is very serious and harmful. That we should reject the West totally and go along with the Russian president and his Eurasian ideal and organizations and so on, because we're controlled by Jews. You know, that's not going to, all that's going to do is kill the West, and then there won't be any more West at all. That's where that's leading, and that's my opinion on that. So once again, I'm going to go to my SkyCon page, and if somebody wants to call in, they're more than welcome to do so, and I'll see your call, and I'll answer it. I've got a couple more little stories here, but I don't know. I must have thought they were important. I'm not going to do this one, but at businessinsider.com, there was an article, special report from Hungary, far-right party spreads ideology tactics. Well, it's about this Slovakian group. I don't think it's actually a political party yet, but they have a 19-year-old leader. This man is the leader of the 19-year-old Slovakian group, Slovenska Politost. So this group has been around for quite a long time. And he's been arguing for racial segregation and humanitarian methods to reduce Roma fertility. He is cooperating with groups in Belarus, Bulgaria, Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, Romania, and Serbia to jointly fight, quote, against the dictate of Brussels, unquote, and to spread the idea of Pan-Slavism, a union of ethnic Slavs. So I find this interesting because there is such a thing as Pan-Slavism still alive and well today. Somebody said to me, why do you call it alive and well? Well, it is. And they are trying to oppose their countries joining the European Union, which is a good thing. And if they unite for this, that's a good thing. If they don't want to at the same time have their people emigrating into Western Europe, they particularly want to get rid of the ones they don't like and send them into Western Europe. So I don't see these groups as totally friendly to our interests, and I think that this has to be understood when you're talking about white nationalism and how wonderful all these nationalist groups are in Eastern Europe. What they have in mind is their own interests, and everybody has their own interests, which is what attracts me again to this European Knights site that I'm not at all sure about, that I was talking about earlier. Okay, now on to Eurasianism. Gabor Bona, who I was always very excited about and supportive, you know, and talked about everything that he did that was good, and talked very positively about Hungary in the last couple of years and what they were doing opposing the European Union, which I think is good. But it's kind of surprising a lot of people that Gabor Bona has now, head of the Jobbik Party, has now embraced union with Turkey and Eurasianism altogether in such a way. So this takes us into a whole new field here. And I just want to comment on some things that taken from this article that he put out. This is a long article. And he embraces people like René Guénon and Julius Evola, who I know are embraced by the New Right as the great heroes, but I'm not a New Rightist, and I'm not a fan of these people myself. So they're, you know, right or wrong, this is not something that appeals to me. But he says in here some things I have highlighted by Gabor Bona is the European Atlantic region, by which we mean the United States and the great economic political powers of Western Europe. So he sees as the enemy. The enemy is the United States and Western Europe. There's no doubt about it. You can say you're the, because of what they've become, but you have to be careful how you talk about that. But I think that they're just against it. They possibly don't think it can be changed. So you'd have to, in a sense, cut it off or destroy it or whatever. They say that they are in the business of violently exporting democracy. No doubt there's truth in that, but there's also a lot of people opposed to it. And what we need to focus on is those in these areas that are opposed to it. That's what needs to be done rather than joining something foreign. As Andrew Anglin is espousing, even though he says he's not, you know, but that is what it comes down to. There's that, and this name Euro-Atlantism is making it into two regions that are separate, opposite, and this Hungarian Jobbik Party is totally in support of the Eastern one, of the Eurasian region, and what Eurasia includes clearly includes Asians. So that doesn't fit white nationalism at all, but somehow that's okay because it's all about culture, and they have a better culture. I don't know. Do they have a better culture? They have a more strict culture, and for a lot of these men, they like that. And they where the man is holding down the woman, and because they think, you know, they're all for that. And as a woman, I can't be for that. I can't be for any of these philosophies in which male power is total and without any concern. And that's not the case in our Europe. Our Europe that we have been a part of for so long, and I feel connected to it, and I feel a part of it. And I know that's not the case among my German kindred and people, that has never been going on there. That's not acceptable. That's Jewish. That's what's Jewish. Well, I'm not really prepared to talk any more about that. He says, okay, let me go on, down further. Jobbik writes, the world's current crisis is an intellectual one. It is a crisis of the human intellect. He was saying it's not a clash of it's not culture or religion, but intellectual between traditional values and anti-traditionalism, which is modern, abnormal, subhuman. He's using that word, which is now increasingly dominating the world. So they want. He goes on to argue quite a bit for traditionalism and about traditionalism. And I have to say again, traditionalism has never. I'm okay with it if it's not too. But the way it's presented by a lot of people, I'm not okay with because it's too much. It's too completely male centered. Going back to the total law of the father and the male, and no rights at all for the female, which is not European, which is not Northern European, which is not part of our pagan ancestors in Europe. We're not like that. So this comes from the Mediterranean and from the Jews, really. Then he goes on to talk about Eurasianism as a geopolitical concept. Continental unity of Europe and Asia, which stretches from the Atlantic to the Pacific, just making that point. And, of course, the map that I showed on this program announcement and it'll be on the program page is, it makes that very clear what this area is. And then he says, he's talking about Nikolai Trubetskoy, as the founder of Eurasianism, and then mentions Alexander Dugin as the key ideologist of the concept. Now, anybody who can accept the work of Alexander Dugin is just not on the same page that I'm on, because I didn't like him from the beginning, and I don't like him. I don't like him. So he says, then they're talking about, he's talking about someone here. I guess Dugin. He tore Russian thinking out of the Eastern Slavic framework and found Genghis Khan as a powerful antitype, the founder of a Eurasian state. You know, here Genghis Khan becomes a hero in this Eurasianism, one of the great founders of it. Ryabchuk adds that there is a certain intellectual civil war going on in the region, particularly in Russia and also in Turkey, about the acceptance of Western values. So, you know, I believe in a lot of Western values, but they are making out like all Western values are no good and junk, and their values are better. So here's one of these proponents is saying that Russia, not only in Turkey, but in Russia, they're having this war over the acceptance of Western values. So would Western people want to join up with a group that is totally anti-Western in its values? I don't think so. You don't know what the heck you're getting into, that's for sure. And that's why, again, I think it's irresponsible of Andrew Anglin, and not that I think he has so much influence. I don't think so. A lot of people look at that site. That doesn't mean they follow what he says or, you know, put a whole lot of stock in it. But I think it's irresponsible to lead us in this direction without even knowing anything about it, just because it makes for good copy and makes for something to get people's, you know, attention, have something to write about. And Eurasianism was created, it says, to oppose the Western, or in our terms, the Euro-Atlantic values. Well, are all our values bad? Heck no. Again, heck no, they're not. Now, supposedly this part is talking about intellectual Eurasianism. And, the only part that I have bolded here was we admit that our answer is rather intuitive, but we can be reassured by the fact that René Guénon, Julius Evola, or Fritzhof Schuon, the key figures in the restoration of traditionalist philosophy, were the ones who had the deepest and clearest understanding of the transcendental metaphysical unity of Eastern and Western religions and cultures. Aha. Yeah, I don't agree with that. These people, René Guénon, Julius Evola, and this Schuon guy, in their traditionalist philosophy, I don't see them as having the deepest and clearest understanding of the unity of Eastern and Western religions and cultures. I think it's all a bunch of hooey myself, and I think an awful lot of Western people and Americans and Europeans both, I'm not fans of those, but a lot of certain kind of men are. Certain kind of men like that. Now, these two things are exactly what is necessary for the success of Eurasianism. These two things. A foundation that can ensure supranational and super religious perspectives, as well as an intellectual centrality. So there you go. It's not national. It's supranational. We have to have something encompassing all the nations, all the Eurasian nations, and a religious perspective for everybody, in order to be successful. That's what he's saying there. Then, I have anything there. Closing thoughts. I'm almost done with this. The aim of this short essay is to outline the basis and lay the foundations for an ambitious and intellectual Eurasianism. Oh, he is the Yavik founder, I think he is, and leader, is saying that he is totally sold on Eurasianism, and this essay he's written, which is long and rather tedious, but he calls it short, is to lay the foundations for an ambitious Eurasianism and an intellectual Eurasianism. Well, he didn't, I read it, but he didn't convince me. Of course, I'm probably not intellectual enough. So I have to say, you know, I revised my, I'm disappointed in a lot of things today because I thought that a lot of things were what I could support and I was, you know, happy about them. And now I'm having to revise everything and pull back. All right. No calls about that. People don't know what to say or they don't want to say anything. You're welcome to call 830-443-4911 if you have something to say. Now I'm going to go to the topic of the racist rabbi that the United States has been honoring for so many years, and that is Schneerson, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, because I think it's really outrageous. And it was just brought up to the attention of the internet community once again by Allison Weir, who I don't agree with her on everything, but she did write this long thing about it. So it's come up in the news again. People are passing it around. And I have talked about Rabbi Schneerson quite a number of times. But I guess I wasn't fully aware of this, that I thought I had this. Move my page just a little bit. Gosh darn, I can't get this quite right. Okay, it's on April 11th, every year, there is something that has been set up on this to call April 11th in the United States Education and Sharing Day USA. And it just so happens that this thing was set up in 1978. Since 1978, by a joint congressional resolution, they asked Jimmy Carter to proclaim something called Education Day USA. And they want on the anniversary of this Schneerson's birth, this Rabbi Schneerson. Yeah, he did come to the United States before his death. He did come to New York and he was active in the United States. However, he was born in Russia. I'll get to that. I'll wait till that comes up. But back to this resolution, who came up with this? Well, there was something else that they list who did it. But the, you know, it was just one of those things that was just kind of pushed through. And so now, but it was supposed to be that somebody was supposed to be honored for Education Day USA, I would think. Somebody, you know, who's done a lot of good work in the field of education. Not that the federal government in the U.S. would pick out somebody good for it, so I suppose it maybe doesn't make much difference. But they put it on Schneerson's birthday, and so every year since 1978, they have honored Schneerson on this day. And without ever thinking about anybody else. And you know, he was still alive when this happened. He didn't die until 94, I think. And all this time, you know, this was going on. Now, Carter went along with it. He went along with everything to do with the Jews. He obeyed. And every president since then has also obeyed this. And the let's see, what is this? Oh, some individual states are now enacting their own observances of Schneerson's birthday on April 11th, with Minnesota and Alabama leading the way. I mean, Alabama is got Schneerson's birthday on their calendar of observances. Why in the heck, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me how these things happen. In the Jewish world, Schneerson has been widely praised for having someone of deep compassion and insight who actually worked to bring Jews back into the fold and created numerous Jewish schools around the world and created social service programs and humanitarian aid. Supposedly, according to the Jewish Virtual Library website, for all people, regardless of religious affiliation or background. But we know that's not true. The Jews are always saying that what they're doing is for all people. But it's always just for their own people and themselves. If you look into it, you don't find any other people being helped. But they say that they're there to help everybody. It's just the usual scam. Here's something that I went to the Jewish Virtual Library to see their article on this, on Schneerson. And here's some facts. In 1992, at the age of 90, he suffered a stroke. I don't have when he came to the United States, though. Well, I'll just go on here. He passed away 2 years later in 1994. On June 12th, well, why is April 11th the day that he was supposed to be, that he's being honored? I don't know. Shortly after he died in 1994, a bill was introduced in the House of Representatives by Congressman Charles Schumer and John Lewis and Newt Gingrich, friends, that good old white conservative Republican, and Jerry Lewis. Jerry Lewis has to be congressman. Was there a congressman Jerry Lewis? Or is that the Jewish comedian Jerry Lewis? I don't know. To bestow on the Rebbe the Congressional Gold Medal. So why should this guy get the Congressional Gold Medal? Only because the Jews want him to get it. And both houses passed the bill by unanimous consent, honoring the Rebbe for his outstanding and lasting contributions towards improving world education, morality, and acts of charity. And you know that the beliefs of the Schneerson's group, the Chabad Lubavitchers, are that the non-Jews are don't have the same kind of human soul that the Jews do. We have a non-human soul. I mean, that is the most extreme sect, and it's a Hasidic sect. And Elie Wiesel his family belonged to a Hasidic sect, but not the Lubavitch sect. But the Lubavitch sect is the largest of the Hasidic groups. It grew so much, and it's the most well known. Today, now let's see here. I'm trying to find where he came. Okay, he started his religious movement in the Polish Russian town of Lubavitch, and that's where he came from. Wrong. I'm sorry. He didn't start it. It was founded in the 1700s in this Polish Russian town of Lubavitch. And it's the largest of about a dozen sects of Hasidism. And he, Schneerson, is the seventh and final Lubavitcher Rebbe's, because in their belief system, there was going to be seven of these leaders who they call rabbis. They're the ones who spell it R-E-B-B-E. It's called a sacred leader. He was going to, when the seventh one came, that was going to be the last one, and it was going to be the Messiah. Well, he turned out to be that one. He was born there in Lubavitch, or somewhere near there anyway, And he lived there until the National Socialists, until the war, and the National Socialists started coming. And he made his way out of there to, I think he got to Sweden or Switzerland. And all these goody-goody Germans that were helping Jews to leave through Sweden, he was one of them that got helped. And he got out, and he eventually got to the United States. So that's how we have we're plagued with this seventh and final Lubavitch Rebbe. Anyway, he died, and everybody was expecting miracles and fantastic things, or they thought he would never die, that he would just, rise up to Jewish heaven or something, and then, show who all the power that he had. Well, of course, none of that happened. It never does. And so in 1994, they went to work trying to make him into somebody super special, so that they could continue to, hold their sect and their religious beliefs together. And, this Lubavitch thing, they have an extreme cult of personality focused on this Schneerson now. And even though what they expected and what he said didn't happen, they still believe it all, and they still follow him. And, they still consider him the Messiah. And, it's said that he implied that this was true while he was still alive. And, so here we have, this crazy, business going, and not only tolerated around here, because there's all these Jews that are members of this. This is a sect. These are the people that put up those candle things every Christmas time. Those menorahs, those giant menorahs, not only in Washington D.C., on the mall, but in towns and cities and airports, wherever they can do it. And they also force these politicians to make some time to receive their delegations, in which they have a photographer taking lots of pictures, and there's about 20 of them surrounding the poor politician sitting there, and they're giving him a menorah, and he's just, smiling and all. And it's just so sickening. There's a whole website with all these pictures on it. But this is a little bit more. There's 3,600 Chabad institutions in over 1,000 cities in 70 countries in the world. And there's only 200,000 adherents. 200,000, and yet they have all this influence and get all this attention for themselves. They're on campuses, and they have centers on campuses, and they hold Chabad summer camps for hundreds of thousands of children, it says. Or they indoctrinate these Jewish kids into these crazy beliefs. He was settled in the United States in Brooklyn. That's where he did all his work, and they reached out from there all over the place. By 1990, that group was taking in, and Schneerson was still alive. They were taking in an estimated $100 million a year in contributions. So, but still we have to ask, it's a powerful organization. And the thing I wanted to say was, and I mentioned this before, not today, on another time, that in Russia, the one Jewish group that Putin is most friendly with and meets with and is this Chabad Lubavitcher. Yeah, and he's from there. He's from Russia. Of course, all these Jews are from Russia, so he's not the only one. But I said that Putin had helped them to build their Museum of Tolerance and Holocaust Remembrance Museum in Moscow, and Putin had even donated a month's salary to it while he was president of the country. Whatever his salary was, he donated it. that 1 month to this thing for them. And he meets with them regularly. And you see pictures of him with them. He's they're kind of his favorite Jewish group. What does that say? I mean, I know that Obama does this and they all do it. But I don't think they personally donate money to their projects. But I suppose Putin thought it was a good idea to have their own Holocaust denial museum. I mean, their own Holocaust remembrance museum in Moscow. And the Lubavitchers had this big plan to do it. They wanted to do it. So he worked with them. He went along with them doing that. But we expect our rotten Jew-run leaders to do it. But if Putin is the kind of person that we're told he is, or will be or something, why would he do it? And he wouldn't have to do it, but he does do it. Now they have a whole bunch here about, and she has written a whole bunch about Schneerson, the Lubavitch teachings, which are terrible, but I'm not going to go into those. What I do have here is, I thought I would say, well, this is a long article too. Here is part of, you know, there's a book written by Israel Shahak, which supposedly exposes a lot of this stuff. And then somebody was writing, people were writing about it or reviewing it or whatever. But there's a thing I've got highlighted here. In his Haaretz article, Rosen, who was Rami Rosen, wrote something called a long article, History of a Denial, which cannot be found online. It supposedly reveals the violence called that's by somebody else. There's a book by Ehud Spritzak. These are Jews. Brother Against Brother, Violence and Extremism in Israeli Politics from Altalena to the Rabin Assassination. But Rosen writes in a Haaretz article, a check of main facts of the Jewish historiography of the last 500 years shows that the picture is different from the one previously shown to us. It includes massacres of Christians, mock repetitions of the crucifixion of Jesus that usually took place on Purim, cruel murders within the family, liquidation of informers, often done for religious reasons by secret rabbinical courts, which issued a sentence of pursuer and appointed secret executions, assassinations of adulterous women in synagogues, or for the cutting of the noses of their noses, women's noses, by command of the rabbis. These are things that some Jewish people have revealed about the history of Judaism because they don't like it, and they try to expose it to change Jewish, ways and means, but they're able to pretty much cover all that up. And why, when all this is known, why do our leaders, including the Russian leader, make friends with these people and give them honors and special things, special days honoring them and medals of honor and so on? Why do they do that? Only because they're all under the control of the Jews, and that includes Putin. Now, the main author of a book, of another book that I was mentioning that Israel Shahak wrote along with Edward Said. Now, Shahak is a Jew. Said is an Arab or a Middle Easterner. Maybe he's a Palestinian. And it says that it was also authored by Norton Mezvinsky. And Norton Mezvinsky is a member of the Lubavitch congregation in New York and is an uncle of Chelsea Clinton's husband. So that's not too close of a relationship. But Chelsea Clinton married a Jew, we know that, and this Jew's uncle is a member of the Lubavitch congregation. Even if these people expose certain things, they still belong to these groups. You know, they still believe in what they're in, basically overall what's being done. And then she ends by saying this. Now this is just something to understand Alison Weir, that while she's exposing the Schneerson-Lubavitchers because she cares about the Palestinians, not because she really cares about Americans, but she wants she's executive director of If Americans Knew, but she wants Americans to rise up, in order to defend the Palestinians. She doesn't even care. She doesn't even think Americans are in any trouble on their own. She sees Americans, just like the Eurasians do, as being the bad people, being, you know, in here, not having anything good about them. They should be defending, non-American and non-white people. That's what they need. That's what we need to be doing. So her little blurb here at the bottom says she's executive director of If Americans Knew and president of the Council for the National Interest. Her book, Against Our Better Judgment, How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel, contains additional information on Rabbi Cook's family connection to American front groups for Israeli terrorists. Cook was unusual in his support for political Zionism. Most Jewish religious leaders at the time considered the movement heretical. Oh, I'm reading the wrong thing here. Weir is not the British historian Weir. All right. You know, this Rabbi Cook was a friend of Elie Wiesel, and Elie Wiesel wrote about him. And I have a picture of him on one of those articles at Elie Wiesel Cons the World. He was a strange guy. He lived in the United States a lot, and he was very, very big in the Zionist movement before they gained statehood and during that time. Anyway, what I meant to read was the last paragraph of what Alison Weir wrote, and she said, unless masses of people contact their congressional representatives to demand a whole new direction, a national education and sharing day that honors an individual who values education and who believes that all people, in the words of the Declaration of Independence, are created equal. So the people like Alison Weir, what they object to in the Jews is that there is their superior sense of themselves, their chosenness, and their blatant sometimes attacks on all non-Jews, but she supports the equality ideal, and this is the conundrum that we find ourselves in, that we don't know. We've got people who are partly friends, partly not friends, share some of our views, but not other of our views. And we have people who are maybe seen more as enemies, but who share some of our views, actually. And it makes it difficult for, let's just say, the average white American, who we would like to influence, to get a grip on any of this. Because it's not clear what we are and where we stand, and then since there's no rule book in white nationalism, like I think something else I was wanting to say was that there's no guidebook, there's no party there amongst certain organizations. There would have been, I suppose, there would have been a set of principles that are held to, and so on, and. But without that, if you just, a person who considers yourself a white nationalist, functioning basically on the internet, talking to other people and writing comments and so on, and following certain things, and maybe having a website or a blog and so on. Everybody can go whatever way they want to go. And of course, I'm a good example of that. You know, I go off, I suppose people think I go off the reservation pretty badly, by my own individual point of view of things. So, but this is, you know, there is no way to hem us all in and to bring us into some kind of togetherness. But I will say that all in all, I am most sympathetic. I'm most interested in, how would I put it? I feel more related to the idea of, individual European nationalism. And I think, if I had a recommendation, if I was, you know, making my recommendation, it would be something fairly much along the line of this, where is it? Of this, European Knights project, although I don't know. I don't know enough about it, and I really am very hesitant to connect myself to it. I'm not connecting myself to it, but some of the ideas, I understand and I think are right. And why is it, why shouldn't we consider that, international white nationalism and, some kind of a, there could be a loose working together, there could be networking among these various groups. But each group needs to, function for its own benefit on its own. And I think that would be the most effective. I think we're distracted by trying to be, international. And think that there's some kind of that white people, all white people think alike and act alike and will agree on what needs, you know, on getting rid of all non-whites. They don't even agree on that. They don't even agree on that. Look at the Jobbik Party and look at Hungary and its embracing of Eurasianism. Look at Russia and its embrace of Eurasianism seems to be, and a lot of other peoples are embracing it. If you listen to what individuals are saying from Slavic countries, they're embracing it. And on this map that I have, I see very clearly, I don't have it in front of me now, but you can see very clearly how small Western Europe looks when it's pitted against this Eurasianism. So obviously it would need to be associated with the Americas in order to compete along those lines at all. And that, you know, could be that we need to make a whole new realignment in our thinking. But at the same time, we can't think in terms of the leaders that we have. This has to be, you know, we have to get rid of these leaders altogether. No way. And so everybody needs to be at work in their own nations to do that. I think that this is such a hard job. I see people like Paul Hickman, and I see people in Britain. I see that more clearly. It's easier to see there for someone, an English-speaking person. I see these parties, and I see the struggle that they have. At the same time, they've become divided and fight among themselves, but for good reason, because there are people interfering from within. So there's always that. There's a lot of things. There's just so many things that can be done to derail our good intentions and our efforts. But this is the only way forward. I think everybody needs to work in their own area. And that's why it's very possible that, the whole, white nationalism worldwide movement is, can cause people to think that somebody else is doing the work and they're doing a better job, and it looks like they just might win anytime now. You know, the next election, they're going to do it, and everybody's watching that. People are watching that and hoping for something there instead of doing something on their own, in their own community, in their own nation, whatever. There's no getting around that. There's no way around it. The only successful groups that we've ever seen have been people who've been very active and activists. Oh, I think you can be activist on the internet, but it, again, it should be national instead of, but right away, in order to get more readers or listeners or to look more important, people reach out to, other nations and, try to bring in other peoples and say, well, how about this? Now I need to make a comment here. Probably there might be some people saying, well, why do you have the white network? What's that? That's just about all white people, isn't it? You're not saying the American white network or anything like that. Well, that's right. And I did, write somewhere recently explaining to someone who was saying, was questioning the name the White Network, that the name of the White Network came about with the idea that it would, that only white people would be on it. It didn't come about with any particular white nationalist position or how whites should do things or which whites we're talking about. But so in a sense, it represents all whites, but it doesn't represent anything. It's just a network that is saying we're only going to be about whites and have whites, and we're not going to include anything in anybody that's non-white. And that was a reaction to networks that appeared to be existing for white people, but were then including non-white people quite a bit. And the idea is that white people can't get along, or can't be interesting enough, or can't find enough things to talk about without including non-white people. So we thought we'd be real strict about that, and we have been. And we haven't changed that one bit. But we don't have, beyond that, we are for the advancement of white people, but we don't have a political platform or anything like that whereby we're standing for any particular group. So in the end, I have to denounce this whole Eurasianism thing. I have to denounce looking toward Putin for any help. I have to question the effectiveness of white nationalism today, and I hope that people, the dialogue will open up, and if it's possible, and people will be thinking in terms of trying to do things that are effective and be willing to maybe let go of some sacred cows or whatever, which are only standing in the way of coming up with something new. All right. Thanks for listening to me today. As I said, on Monday, I'm going to talk about the whether 86 Jews were gassed at Natzweiler concentration camp. Get back into the revisionism. So I'll see you then on Monday. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.